Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Amiel Alkali is a poet, translator, critic, scholar, and activist who teaches at Queens College and the Graduate Center, CUNY. His books include Scrap Metal, Factory School 2006, From the Warring Factions, Beyond Baroque 2002, and a notable translation of Sarajevo Blues. Among his most notable contributions with Anne Waldman and others, as an initiator of Poetry is News Coalition, and he organized with Mike Kellerer the Olson Now Project, most recently through the PhD program in English and the Center for the Humanities at the Graduate Center. He launched Lost and Found, the CUNY Poetics Document Initiative, a series of student and guest-edited archival texts emerging from the new American poetry. Welcome to The Thought Project, Amiel.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, it is a great honor to welcome you here today, Amiel. You have packed in a pretty remarkable life as a human being, firstly. You're a poet, a political activist, a writer, a book author, a translator, and a journalist. I would not call you a typical professor, stored away into the ivory tower. You are anything but that. What do you have to say about that?
Well, thank you for that characterization, because it's one of the things that I actually am proud of, you know, in that I haven't taken a very direct path to where I am now. And it's not even that I feel like I've arrived somewhere. It's just part of the whole journey.
The gestalt.
I certainly didn't have a very, you know, a very illustrious academic career. I mean, I barely got out of high school because I think, as I, you know, as we've talked about before, my high school years were 1969 to 1973, and I grew up in Boston, and there were a lot more interesting things to do than go to school in those years.
Those were tumultuous years.
Very tumultuous.
I was in high school at the same time.
Yeah, and so I always felt that, that was where I was learning things. That was where I was learning things. And neither did I go to college after high school. I worked, and eventually I started taking some classes. I ended up, of all places, at City College uptown, from which I dropped out at a certain point. And, it's a long kind of circuitous story. But throughout it, I always worked. I did all kinds of work, you know, dozens of jobs. And I have a book called Scrap Metal, which is divided into work interludes, and there are about 30 or 40 of them. And when I finished the book, I said, well, wait a second. I forgot about the time I was driving a limousine. I forgot about the time I was doing this, I was doing that. And that is very much part of, you know, part of who I am, how I was formed, and how I think about work, you know, because this is another form of work that we do.
So your description of your work, as I want the audience to know, is it ran the gamut pretty much from grade school till getting a job at Queens College in 1990. You were a short order cook. You did auto body work, classic car restoration, used car sales, carpentry, construction, painting, museum displays, interstate trucking, furniture moving, laundromat manager, bookstore manager, limousine driver, courtroom interpreter, translator, journalist, and dozen of other jobs. Most of those, the vast majority of those, were really working class. Mm-hmm. Some of those were high skilled, but that clearly would enrich your human experience, which is like a fertilization for somebody who emerges as a poet out of those experiences.
Well, you know, it's a bit of an odd situation. I mean, I grew up very solidly middle class, but given that my father was a painter and income was kind of contingent upon how the paintings were doing, and due to various issues at home, I found myself not wanting to be there a lot. So I started working really young, you know, like really young, paper route, you know, snow shoveling, whatever I could get my hands on. And that immediately followed into more skilled things, you know, where I went to a high school where we had a manual training building. So I did print shop and metal shop and woodworking and auto mechanics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just, I like doing that kind of stuff. I have, and I, you know, a do-it-yourselfer.
Absolutely. So you're also the child of immigrants. And that, too, must have definitely shaped your worldview and your experiences. Knowing you a little bit, I know that your parents were from Belgrade.
Right.
And since that's part of my research area as a scholar.
Sure. Well, you know, like many other people, they were displaced in the Second World War. They ended up in circuitously, separately in Italy, where they lived until 1951. And then they came to the States, where I was born. So, you know, I've also kind of that generation that I think has kind of relived the immigrant experience in a weird way, because I left the country for quite some time and then reacclimated to coming back to it. But, you know, it's a chance operation. I could have been born in Italy. I could have been born in any number of places.
Of course,
you know?
Yes.
So, you know, I think there are all kinds of forms of identity that one latches onto in that situation that are not really normal. They're quite exaggerated. And, you know, it's something that I think takes a lifetime to even begin coming to terms mm-hmm. with and trying to figure out.
And unpack it.
Yeah.
So from all of that, you graduated, finished your PhD here at the Graduate Center, and you're a highly respected, renowned comparative literature professor. Some people, I talked to people about you and your work, and I became familiar with your work here over the last several years. But it would seem that your greatest contribution to the field and to CUNY itself and here at the Graduate Center with graduate students is the launching, a collective launching, but you've played a central role in establishing Lost and Found, the CUNY Poetics Document Initiative, from which graduate students, and I imagine even scholars, working scholars, can publish original texts by figures, writers, poets, central to and associated with new American poetry. I'm going to quote somebody who was on your board, the former U.S. Poet Laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, who said, "The Lost and Found Project is a place where I go to find myself again. I meet geniuses and early day friends that I met on the road, like Kathy Ocker, Diane DePrima, and Adrian Rich." Wow.
Yeah. Well, let me try to tell you a little bit about Lost and Found and its genesis. There's a bunch of different strands. One is on the very local level. Not that long ago, our students were unfunded. They were teaching three courses. They were taking three courses. They had families. They couldn't possibly dream of doing real research in an extended way. And so we kept trying to figure out ways in which the idea of a publication project could come into a seminar. And so I came up with a course that was ostensibly something like contemporary textual scholarship. I'm trained as a medievalist. Okay, so I come into teaching contemporary things with a very different point of view. I often feel that people who are doing contemporary things sometimes lack a little historical perspective. And if one is doing medieval things, you're immediately confronted with all kinds of unknowns. What is the manuscript? Where did it come from? What state was it in? Is it complete? All those kinds of things. So at the same time, having you know, being a student of ancient civilizations, both, you know, African, Middle Eastern, indigenous, et cetera, you know, those civilizations lasted many thousands of years. We're talking about a country here that is, as a country, 400 years old. So one of the things that's foremost in my mind is, you know, how does our memory get transmitted? How does our memory move? How does it get retained? How does it get preserved? Who does that? How does that work? How does that work amongst younger people? You know, the people who were sitting in Sarajevo when the Oriental Institute was bombed didn't probably think that that might be the first target or one of the first targets of the war. Their archives, likewise in Iraq, when the archives were, you know, the oil ministry was guarded, but not the archives.
Right.
So, you know, we are very complacent here and we tend to think, well, it's stable, everything's fine, our archives, we have buildings and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not the case. Things are very precarious and people of different situations may end up with all their life's work in a dumpster, you know, if they end up without money or all kinds of things. So my feeling was, having grown up in this milieu of the work that really follows the Cold War, and being a kind of student of history, I really felt like something very unique went on in that period. Something very unique went on in that period. And having a personal connection to some of the pretty important people in that period, I felt like this is something I really have, I'm able to transmit on a personal level and through my own relationship to these people. And so the project was conceived in that way, in which really it's a, you know, the work that goes into a single lost and found chapbook is, I mean, I'm somebody who's, I think I've worked with about 60 dissertations at this point, okay? And somebody working on a lost and found chapbook is really often doing more meticulous and exact work than in a whole dissertation because they have to get it right. There's no thinking involved. I mean, there's plenty of thinking, but it has to be right. We have to get our facts right.
To be
we have
accurate.
To get it has to be accurate.
Right. Right.
And there's an accommodation to the people. We're not talking about just pieces of paper. We're talking about families, heirs, all the people who, you know, and there's so many stories I could tell you.
Legacy.
For instance, yeah. You know, Adrian Rich's archive is closed for 50 years for various reasons that she had.
I didn't know that.
And so there's no biography, and there won't be for quite some time. And when we began working on her, we realized this might be a problem because how are we going to get permission? So through a friend, I found out, oh, Adrian's son lives in my building. We're friends. So I said, how do I get in touch with him? So we start talking, and it was not that long after she died. And she was somebody who had actually written me a fan letter once, which almost, you know, I almost collapsed when I got it. but once we started talking, he said, oh, it's CUNY. That's great. You know, she would really be proud of that. And once we started explaining what we were doing, he became completely enthusiastic and supportive and actually spoke at our launch, you know, for that series. And then that went on into a whole series of discovering the pedagogical work of poets who had taught at CUNY.
Right.
June Jordan, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, Tony
right.
K. Bambara, and there are many more that
These
we haven't
giants.
That we haven't discovered yet.
Yeah.
And it's a legacy that people really don't know about.
Yeah, so it was you did a series on Adrienne Rich's pedagogy.
Yeah, her syllabi and her exercises and her memos to the, you know, again, during tumultuous times, during open admissions and all of that.
Yes. So speaking of that, you know, your manifesto for Lost and Found is follow the person.
Sure.
And given that you were, you are a trained medievalist, I can see why you have a certain perspective because, like you said, things can disappear. Paper, you know, doesn't exist. You know, it can be destroyed. It can fade away. The ink can fade. So this has become your manifesto and your direction to graduate students. And how does that what have you learned from that?
Well, what happens is people, younger people learn about some of these figures. They read an anthology. Okay.
Right.
And so Poet X is, you know, the poets become like fish. You know, they're in different schools and they only swim in that school and right. they don't cross any right. other waters. So they're, you know, New York school or this school or that school. So what I do is I bring in a pile of little magazines from the period and I say, you know, spend some time, look at them. And they go, why is so-and-so in here with so-and-so? And I said, well, find out, you know. And then people begin to realize, they look at correspondence. They look at, and they say, who is being, what is taking up somebody's attention? Who are they talking about? Who are they interested in? Who are they uninterested in? You know, what is their world picture? Who's in their world? And all of those things start to break down, you know, all things that have been constructed by various, you know, sometimes for means of efficacy, sometimes academically, whatever. There's all kinds of reasons why those things get constructed. But, you know, we did a project, for instance, on a – this is very timely because of what's going on in Algeria. We did a project on a poet by the name of Jean Sénac, who was a yes. revolutionary poet in Algeria. And one of the reasons why we were able to put him in was because he had a radio show. And on his radio show, he featured what he thought of as revolutionary American poets, such as Bob Kaufman, Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, et cetera. So it made perfect sense for him to be in this mix that we're creating. So the point of following the person is to really create a new map, you know, that people have wouldn't be able to find.
Mm-hmm. And document the geography.
And document the geography of it and the relationships, really.
Interesting. In the process of this, you had fellow collaborators and it was a collective, but you also mentioned your mentors. And just share with us, because you have had mentors and continue to have mentors, you know, through your entire adult life. But certainly you probably learned a lot from those being mentored and how you've passed that on to your own students.
Sure. Well,
particularly in this project, it would seem.
Sure, sure. Well, one person who was very important to me is a poet by the name of Vincent Farini, who is mostly known because a more famous poet, Charles Olson, who was also a family friend, began his life work, the Maximus poems, as letters to Vincent because they both lived in the town of Gloucester, Massachusetts. So Vincent is somebody who knew me from birth, and I started to be more, you know, involved with him when I was a teenager because I was starting to get interested in poetry, write about poetry, showing him my poems, and he was reading them, and, you know, we were corresponding, we were meeting. And Vincent is somebody whose life is in many ways quite extraordinary, and I didn't know the full extent of it until I did a project on him based on his archive. And Vincent was somebody, his parents were immigrants from Italy. He worked in factories in Lynn, Mass, which mm-hmm. was, and he ended up working in the electricians union at General Electric. He was a communist for a while. He was hounded by HUAC, very political. He left the party. He left Lynn at a certain point, and he moved 8-10 miles north to Gloucester because he was being persecuted. And he actually left before he got his pension, and he opened a tiny little frame shop, which was what he did for the rest of his life. He was a picture framer. And his perspective on things, as somebody who grew up seeing his sister die next to him because the heater blew up, you know, from poverty, he was somebody who impressed me greatly with his humanity, his authenticity, his feeling for life and what he had been through and how that translated into what the meaning of poetry could be. So he was a very important mentor for me.
A seminal figure.
Yeah. And many others. I mean, Gilbert Sorrentino was an extraordinary poet, novelist, critic who I took a few classes from at the New School. And he's the one who said, stop taking classes with me. Go learn something. You know how to write, you know. And he said, go learn some languages. And that's when I enrolled at as a there was a trick then because I didn't have I don't even think I had my SAT scores were non-existent. So there was a thing called SGS at the time, which was School of General Studies, which was basically night school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enrolled in that, knowing the trick was you could take anything. You didn't have to take night classes. So I started studying ancient Greek and Latin at City, which I loved.
Which is the foundation of all languages.
Which I really loved that, yeah. And that was a real basis. And we had an extraordinary linguist who taught us Latin, who gave us a chart of sound changes. So whatever new vocabulary words came up, he would say, well, give me that in old French. Give me that in Italian. Give me that in, you know. So we basically learned all the Romance languages as we learned Latin.
So speaking of which, I would argue that also one of your most important contributions to the field is especially your translations of writings. And, of course, I'm going to zero right in on from Serbo-Croat into English as a consequence of the Bosnian War, but also Spanish. And from Hebrew, including the books of Keys to the Garden, New Israeli Writing, which was a co-translation of Outcast by Shimon Ballas, and also the Neruda Prize recipient Jose Kozer. You have also published translations from Latin, Arabic, Italian, and French. And that is substantial. I immediately, of course, thought of Elizabeth Bishop, who did mm-hmm. significant translations. And that's not something you ordinarily think of when you think about people who are poets. But serious poets and serious writers seem to yield to that. And I would say you truly leveraged your role as a translator in writings in the former Yugoslavia, specifically on Bosnia. You translated Sarajevo, a journal by Slatko Dostadovic, who I happen to know, in the 10th Circle of Hell. Also by camp survivor Rezek Kukanovic, and other translations, including, I think, one of the most famous would be Sarajevo Blues, and the Nine Alexandrias by Bosnian poet Samezdin Mehmedinović. Also, Dinović is a significant Bosnian poet. You made these writings available to the world, and we were watching this war on CNN. It was the first war to watch in real time. And you also did some significant organizing during the siege just last week. The 27th anniversary mm-hmm. was recognized. You were a key organizer of political and cultural events there, which I can just see for Sarajevo, which was the first U.S. publication to explore the context of the war with a global view. And I mean, that was really a breakout war, unfortunately, for a lot of people. It affected a lot of people. And a lot of people came to the aid of Bosnia, too, in different ways. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm holding a conference tonight at Columbia and tomorrow, and we're going to, like, take a look at how human rights has evolved mm-hmm. In that part of the world, where we're at. And have we over-examined poor Bosnia? What have academics done? Have they been ethical or not? Mm-hmm. So you've engaged in, I'm sure, all these conversations and discussions.
Sure.
But I would argue that it was a significant part of your contribution.
Well, there's so much I can say about that. First of all, one of the other things that I do is I teach translation at the Queen's College MFA in Creative Writing and Literary Translation, which is one of only two places in the country that really concentrates on teaching translation in an MFA context. So, and actually had two students in the last few years doing ex-Yugo work.
Oh, really?
Which was extraordinary. But, okay, there's so much one can say about this. First of all, I'll just say during the war, the wars of ex-Yugoslavia, I was actually, for almost close to 2 years, I was the only translator working in this country from Bosnian.
Yes, duly noted.
That is kind of crazy.
Yes, because all the other translators were working with the international organizations, right?
Or, you know, they just were not, my work ranged from, you know, faxes that I was getting from people in villages that were being overrun to, you know, the work of journalists like Zlatko Dizdarević or the work of like a survivor like Reza Kukanović.
Right.
Always keeping my eye on what are the poets doing. And what I was very conscious of throughout was not to make decisions on my own, but to kind of collectively come to a decision about what people there felt ought to be translated. Because I didn't want to be this American swooping in and choosing this or that, you know. So, for instance, with Sarajevo Blues, which you mentioned, I kept asking people, what is the thing that really expresses what's going on? And everybody said, Sarajevo Blues. If you can do that, that really expresses what we're thinking about.
Right.
Now, curiously, I've been thinking about this a lot the last few days. You mentioned Forza Sarajevo, which was a journal called Lusitania that a friend of mine named Martim Aviles put together. And originally it was meant to be a commemorative issue for the 500th anniversary of the expulsion of Jews and Arabs from Spain that I was working on with a Palestinian friend, Kamal Bulata. And we started that in 1990, I think, or late 89. And when the siege started, it was clear, well, this is actually the story. So what we did with that issue was... about half the issue was material directly from Bosnia, historical and current. And the rest of it were people that I felt needed to be in the same room. And this was in a situation where the literary scene that I was seeing in the U.S. was very apartheid-like. You know, it was really divisive or not even conscious. It was just completely separate. So I brought people into the room of all types, you know, that hadn't been together. And putting them together in relationship to Bosnia was very significant, I thought, you know, as a statement about what that was actually about. So all of my work has really been also about challenging readers here to think about, you know, not that I'm like some savior bringing this stuff to, you know, but actually, you know, when people read Sarajevo Blues when it came out, I was saying, how about thinking about your own work in relation to what's going on in the world, you know, and it was very effective, very, very effective in that way, I think, all those translations that I did.
Yes. One reviewer said about this translation, said that the final selection, unfortunately, I didn't have a copy of the book, so I wouldn't want to hear what you have to say about this. A fascinating interview between Mehmed Dinović and Amiel Alekhai, who translated this volume, is a thoughtful, moving analysis of his life as a writer, both in Bosnia and in exile.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that I feel, you know, so often translations, I mean, I've been translating for a long time. I've been translating since the late 70s, really, because I'm still of that ilk cut my teeth as a poet on Ezra Pound. And if you do that, you have to translate.
I mean,
that's like doing your scales if
you're
a musician.
That's like 101.
Yeah,
it's poetry 101.
If you're a musician, you do your scales. If you're a dancer, you do your exercises. If you're a poet, you translate. That's just a given. I feel like the U.S. still has a kind of consumer relationship to translation. It's like, we need Iranian women. Now we need this or that. It's like
it's
having
utilitarian.
It's utilitarian. It's like we need cherries in the winter, so we'll get them from And what gets lost in that is everything that is not the literary piece. In other words, the polemics, the letters, the biographies, the journals.
The color.
The whole texture.
Right, the texture, yes.
So whenever I do a translation, I insist that there be other materials involved, an interview, an essay, something to put a little bit of perspective on this text. Because otherwise what happens is it just kind of re-emphasizes the generic preciousness of, you know, poetry or a novel. but doesn't really get into what its meaning might be carried over into another cultural context. And political context,
and
obviously.
Political, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Is there something you'd want to read? Is there something that appeals to you to read for our audience?
Since we've talked about translation, I'll read a translation from Sarajevo Blues, and then I'll read a piece of mine from The Warring Factions, which is dedicated to the town of Srebrenica.
Right, Srebrenica.
And I'll talk about that. These are very short. I'll read two pieces by Semezdin Mehmedinović from Sarajevo Blues, published by City Lights. This is called Corpse. We slow down at the bridge to watch some dogs tear a corpse apart by the river. And then we went on. Nothing in me has changed. I heard the crunch of snow under tires like teeth biting into an apple, and felt the wild desire to laugh at you because you call this place hell, and you flee from here convinced that death outside Sarajevo does not exist. Yeah. So that's a poem in which the poet, refuses the terms of, life goes on.
Right.
And this is
moment to moment. Yeah. Life goes on. Yes.
A martyr's resting place. A body just about to be buried. I see a soldier on his knees, still a kid. His rifle rests in his lap. You can hear the guttural murmur of Arabic. Sorrow gathers in circles under the eyes. The men pass their open palms across their faces. As the rites continue, I feel the presence of God in everything. When this is over, I will take a pen and make a list of my sins. Now everything in me resists death. As my tongue passes over my teeth, I can sense the taste of a woman's lipstick. No one is crying. I keep quiet. A cat jumps across the shadow of a minaret. Which, again, has the typical mix of what Bosnia was. Minarets, lipstick, cats.
True. True.
And death. Now, this is a piece from a section. I'll just say something briefly. I don't know how we're doing on time, but I'll just say something briefly about From the Warring Factions. From the Warring Factions is a book-length poem written almost in an epic style. And other than a very few pieces, I used words that were not my own. But I used them the way a painter would use colors. In other words, I created lists of single words taken from other places. And in the final three poems that is the section that actually deals specifically with the events at Srebrenica, I used words from the poet Shelley's Revolt of Islam, because it was the only canonical English work I could think of that has the word Islam in it. And I thought it might be useful to think about what his words, how his words would work in this context.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the final poem in that series. Suddenly, like shapes of living stone, clothed in the light of dreams, I tore the veil, the shrouds which wrap the world, the frost of death, the flood of tyranny, a paradise of flowers, within which the poor heart loves to keep the earnings of its toil, a common home, stains of inevitable crime, pride built upon oblivion, to rule the ages that survive our remains, violence and wrong, an unreturning stream, the grief of many graves, snow and rain on lifeless things. This is not faith or law, opinion more frail, or life poison in its wells that delights in ruin. As endless armies wind in sad procession, the earth springs like an eagle, even as the winds of autumn scatter gold in the dying flame. We learn to steep the bread of slavery in tears of woe. These faded eyes have survived a ruin wide and deep, which can no longer borrow from chance or change what will come within the homeless future. That gold should lose its power and thrones their glory, that love which none may bind be free to fill the world like light, whose will has power when all beside is gone faint accents far and lost to sense of outward things, some word which none here can gather. Yet the world has seen a type of peace, some sweet and moving scene returning to feed on us, as worms devour those years, come and gone like the ship which bears me in this, the winter of the world.
This is a moment in the world. I mean, the world has experienced many terrible moments, but that actually that poem really does speak to how, really kind of how I feel at this moment. But I don't want this podcast to be over before we talk a little bit about the fact that actually both of us grew up in a really tumultuous time. And it feels like, and it is very obvious just looking at real social science, that tumultuous time has once again returned, not only to the United States, but I think into the entire world. I would argue that this is a moment for poets and writers to return to help us mm-hmm. deal with what we're dealing with. And so the morning after the fifth re-election of the Prime Minister of Israel, many people are very upset about that event. Perhaps he may be facing jail. It's possible he's under investigation. We shall see what happens. It sounds similar to our own president, mm-hmm. who's under investigation, has been under investigation now by the U.S. Congress. And this indeed is a tumultuous time. So what does the poet say in you about this, Amiel?
What the poet does, what I've been doing, is I've been writing probably for the last 3 years almost, poems that actually, I shouldn't say this on the air, but I will. I often write these while I drive. I have a long commute. And so I managed to get a notebook on the steering wheel. And all I need,
wow.
is a few words to catch the drift.
Okay.
But they're based on, there was a beloved poet of mine, Edward Dorn, who during the 80s wrote a series of things called Abhorrences. And those were actually taken up by his very dear friend, Amiri Baraka, who started to write what he called lokus, not haikus, mm-hmm. but lokus. And so I've been writing what I call imperial abhorrences and other abominations. And essentially what I'm doing is I'm looking at the contradictions that take place in plain language and how things that we hear or things that come across the news to us are so packed with historical significance and they just go right by you. So maybe as a way of closing, I might read a couple of those.
Let's do that, yes.
And again, I feel like these are, you know, very short historical treatises. And this one might be based on an extraordinary book called The Politics of Heroin by Alfred McCoy, who's a great historian and who was originally given to think about these issues through a Freedom of Information Act that the poet Allen Ginsberg opened on the drug trade, the international drug trade, consumer demand. If you think of the United States of America as one huge nostril, a very long arm, or even a voracious mouth reaching down to the Andes and across the fields of Afghanistan, the golden triangle morphing into a shape even Euclid couldn't have imagined, then you're beginning to get the picture. In an 8-minute segment of The Takeaway about African refugees in Israel hosted by Todd Zwillick on NPR, the word Palestinian wasn't mentioned once. I actually heard this. I was on Route 95. It was snowing. Inflation. As life gets cheaper, bullets don't. When the bad day comes and the banks collapse and there's a run on food, who on this good earth would even want to give us humanitarian aid? The Belt Road Initiative, a new radial tire? The democracy in action. After all this high drama to pick a new supreme, it's quite a relief to see that the lifers and the choicers can all agree on one principle: the absolute necessity of starving, maiming, and killing as many Yemenis as possible, preferably children. I'd call them crapheads, but far be it for me to disparage Noble John, inventor of the crapper. Literary history. To attend a reception in his honor in 1945, Aimé Césaire had to use the service elevator. Translation theory. Maybe some of these people who think they can translate Hafiz or Rumi freely without even knowing the language ought to try working Gitmo, like my friend Khaled, where he couldn't say a word someone else hadn't already said. Two more. Khashoggi or Khashoggi? From an American perspective, perhaps the most notable thing about the case of the Saudi journalist was that for two straight days, no matter where you turn, from NPR to Fox or CNN, they all pronounced his name Khashoggi. It was as if the NSA had installed a pronunciation chip into the collective mind of the MSM. Exercise. Every day, try and imagine how far you are from Gaza. March 23rd, 2019. Over the smoldering ruins, having forgotten or never even known of the achievement of Egyptian stonework in granite and diorite, honed absolutely flat and level to a thousandth of an inch, the lizard men and surviving humanoids collectively paw over one of the 21st century's only artifacts, the highly redacted remains of, yes, the Mueller report.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today, and we'll have you back because these locus or these
abhorrences,
these abhorrences are a necessity for some mental relief.
Mental relief, exactly.
Mental relief. So thank you so much for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to today's guest, Professor Amiel Al-Khalai. The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Sarah Fishman. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.